You know, when you look up at like the massive steel arches of a suspension bridge, or if you're just staring at the exposed skeleton of a skyscraper going up, your brain immediately categorizes that metal as completely permanent.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is the definition of solid.
Right. It's the ultimate symbol of something that just does not change. We literally use the phrase nerves of steel to describe someone who is totally unwavering.
Yeah, and we kind of rely on that illusion of permanence, you know, just to feel safe walking into a massive building or driving your car over a river.
Exactly. But then if you zoom in, like if you actually look through an electron microscope at the literal seams holding our entire world together.
Or welds.
Yeah, the welds joining those massive plates of steel. You realize really quickly that static is a complete myth.
Oh, it's a totally different world down there.
It is. You are actually looking at this microscopic time lapse of structural collapse in chaos and reconstruction.
It's incredibly dramatic once you get down to the atomic level. I mean, it is essentially a war zone of elements fighting for physical and chemical equilibrium, and honestly, often failing to find it.
And decoding that microscopic war zone is basically our mission for today's deep dive. So we've got our hands on a really fascinating, highly technical metallurgical paper.
Very technical, yeah.
For sure. It's titled Reaustenitization in Steel Weld Deposits by J.R. Yang and HKDH Padesia out of the University of Cambridge.
It's a fantastic piece of research.
It really is. We are going to use their work to sort of uncover the hidden drama that happens inside steel welds when they get reheated. Because as this paper reveals, the internal structure of this metal actually breaks standard thermodynamic rules.
Yeah, it completely ignores the rule book. I mean, for anyone fascinated by how the physical world is actually built, understanding the secret life of a steel weld reveals these incredible invisible forces that are, you know, actively holding our infrastructure together.
Right. But before we get to the whole rule-breaking rebel metal part, we probably need to map out the landscape for you listening at home. Like, let's talk about how these massive structural welds are actually made in the first place.
Right, because you don't just glue a bridge together in one go with a single blowtorch.
Exactly. You use a process called multi-pass welding.
Yeah, when you are joining thick, heavy plates of high-strength steel, you really can't simply do one giant weld. I mean, it just wouldn't hold.
It would just crack, right?
Most likely, yeah. So you have to lay down multiple overlapping beads of molten metal, one right after the other, filling the joint layer by layer.
Good.
And when that very first layer of molten weld is deposited and it cools down, it forms what we call a primary microstructure.
Right. And in the specific high-strength alloy this paper is looking at, that primary structure is mostly made of two distinct elements, right?
Correct.
There's this surrounding matrix of something called austenite, and then these rigid, needle-like formations called acicular ferrite.
Yeah, and scientists and engineers have actually spent decades studying that primary structure. We're quite good at predicting it, actually.
Because it's just the first layer cooling down.
Exactly. We understand the thermodynamics of how that first pool of liquid metal cools, crystallizes, and forms those microscopic needles. And that predictable science is what allows engineers to design really effective welding consumables.
Which are just the physical rods of metal you melt to create the weld, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But because it's a multi-pass weld, the welder doesn't just stop at layer one. They come back, you know, a few minutes later and lay down a second layer of molten metal, which is what, thousands of degrees?
Oh, easily.
Right, directly on top of the first one. So let's just unpack this for a second. It seems like laying down boiling hot asphalt on top of freshly cooled asphalt.
That's a great way to picture it.
The sheer violent heat from the new layer must just fundamentally alter the foundation beneath it.
It really does. The heat from the new weld bead forces the already cooled steel below it to undergo a massive thermal shock. It basically forces the metal to transform all over again.
Wow.
Yeah, the microscopic needles of acicular ferrite try to turn back into the surrounding austenite matrix.
Okay.
And predicting this reheated structure is just a massive unsolved puzzle in metallurgy. I mean, it depends on the alloy's exact chemistry, how fast the heat penetrates, how quickly it dissipates.
Like, there's too many variables.
Exactly. It's an area where our best predictive models just totally fall apart.
So wait, if I'm driving over a bridge in the middle of winter, the solid steel weld holding the roadway up beneath my tires has actually gone through multiple violent heat cycles before it ever even left the construction site.
Oh, absolutely. Long before.
But why is it so hard to predict what happens to this reheated foundation? I mean, if we know exactly how steel behaves when it cools down, shouldn't we know exactly how it behaves when we heat it back up?
You would think so.
It seems like it should just be the exact same process in reverse.
You would naturally assume that, yeah. But this specific internal structure exhibits this almost stubborn refusal to follow expected thermodynamic laws.
Okay, a stubborn metal.
Yeah. Let's look at that reverse transformation where the acicular ferrite tries to turn back into austenite. In metallurgy, this is called the alpha to gamma transformation.
Right. And according to the standard rules of thermodynamics, specifically something the paper calls the lever rule, this should be a fairly straightforward math equation.
It should be, yes.
The lever rule basically states that at a given temperature, an alloy must have a very specific ratio of phases. It's kind of like a recipe, right?
Exactly like a recipe.
If you heat the alloy up into a specific temperature range, which is called the alpha plus a gamma phase field, it should immediately start transforming to match the recipe for that specific temperature.
Oh, the metal doesn't do that.
Really?
Yeah, you heat it up into that specific zone, and the steel just sits there. It completely ignores the lever rule. The transformation is massively delayed.
But how does a physical material just ignore the fundamental laws of thermodynamics? I mean, it's not a living thing making a choice.
Well, to understand why the steel rebels against the heat, you have to look really closely at how those microscopic needles, the acicular ferrite, formed in the very first place during that initial cooling pass.
Okay.
They do not grow slowly. It's not individual atoms casually diffusing and rearranging themselves into a new pattern.
So it's not a slow build.
No. They grow through a process called a diffusionless displacive mechanism.
Wait, let me stop you there. Diffusionless displacive mechanism. Are we basically saying it's not a chemical mixing process, but rather a physical movement?
Yes. Think of a deck of cards sitting neatly on a table.
Okay.
If you push the side of the top card, the whole deck suddenly slants forward.
Right.
The individual cards didn't mix together or trade places, right? They just physically slid into a new slanted shape.
Oh.
That is what the atoms are doing during the initial cooling. It is a massive physical shearing of the crystal lattice, not a slow chemical mixing. It's this sudden, violent snap into place, very similar to another steel microstructure called bainite.
So the internal structure physically and forcefully snaps into its needle shape.
Yes, but here is the critical part that breaks all the rules later on.
Okay.
This initial physical snap stops prematurely.
Ah, the paper calls this the classical incomplete reaction phenomenon.
Exactly. It means the physical shearing reaction just ceases well before the remaining leftover austenite achieves its natural balanced carbon concentration.
Why does it stop?
Well, in thermodynamics, there is a theoretical limit called the T0 curve. You can kind of think of the T0 curve as a thermodynamic wall.
Okay.
When the metal hits that wall, the physical snapping just quits. The carbon atoms get partitioned and shoved into the leftover austenite, but not enough of them make it across to reach true equilibrium.
Wait, so it's like a tightly coiled wind-up toy that just mysteriously stops uncoiling before it runs out of tension?
Yes, that's exactly it.
But if the carbon atoms haven't reached their balanced, happy state, why does the reaction just throw its hands up and quit? It is bizarre that the metal essentially just freezes in this unfinished, highly tense state.
It is entirely bizarre, and it is exactly why the reverse reaction, the reheating from the second pass of the welder's torch, is so incredibly delayed. The metal is locked in a state that doesn't make standard thermodynamic sense. It's carrying this huge debt from its initial incomplete formation.
It was basically stuck.
Yeah, and to figure out how to force the metal to unlock and continue changing, the Cambridge researchers couldn't just throw a piece of steel in a regular furnace and watch what happened.
Because it wouldn't do anything.
Right, they had to devise some incredibly extreme experimental methods.
Because if the metal is locked and refusing to change when we heat it, how on earth do you force it to reveal its secrets? You need to catch this shape-shifting steel in the act, literally measuring microsecond intervals.
Mm.
And you can't exactly use a camera for that.
No, optical observation is totally useless here. So they used a piece of equipment called a Theta Industries high-speed dilatometer.
Dilatometry.
Yeah, it's a brilliant scientific technique. Instead of looking at the metal, you are measuring incredibly tiny microscopic changes in the physical length of the specimen.
Oh, because it changes size.
Exactly. As the internal crystal structure of the steel shifts from those fairy needles back into austenite, the physical arrangement of the atoms changes, which means the actual volume of the metal contracts and expands.
So the metal breathes.
Precisely, it breathes. So they took these tiny rods machined directly from real weld deposits, and I mean microscopic rods, just 3 millimeters in diameter and 15 millimeters long.
Tiny.
Yeah, and they plated them in a microscopic 0.08 millimeter layer of pure nickel and then ran the entire experiment inside a vacuum chamber filled with helium gas.
I assume the nickel and the helium are there to protect the sample, because at the crazy temperatures we were talking about, wouldn't regular oxygen in the air just instantly turn the outside of the steel into rust?
Oh, immediate.
And that would completely ruin any microscopic measurements of its length, right?
Exactly. The helium environment completely prevents any surface degradation or oxidation from messing with the highly sensitive data.
But the really fascinating part of the experimental setup, to me at least, is how they heated it. They used a water-cooled radio frequency furnace.
Yes.
And the paper notes it has essentially zero thermal mass. I want to make sure we understand why that matters. Like, if I turn on my oven at home, it takes 20 minutes to heat up because the heating elements have to heat the air, and then the air has to heat the walls, and then the air finally heats my food. That oven has huge thermal mass.
Right, a radio frequency furnace bypasses all of that entirely. It uses intense electromagnetism to heat the metal sample directly from the inside out, almost instantaneously.
Wow.
Because the furnace itself has zero thermal mass, it doesn't need to warm up. It can blast the steel with heat at terrifying speeds.
And they had to do this, right, to avoid the metal taking the slow route of changing shape.
Exactly. The slow route is standard diffusional decomposition. They needed to force the issue using a technique called upquenching.
Upquenching, that just sounds
It
intense.
is. They used the radio frequency furnace to heat the metal so rapidly to specific temperatures. We're talking between 680 degrees Celsius and 760 degrees Celsius, and then held it there isothermally.
Isothermal, meaning they held it at a perfectly constant, unchanging temperature.
Right, just to record those microscopic length changes on the computer.
This is where it gets really interesting to me. The upquenching is so incredibly fast, it completely isolates the reaction. It's like trying to take a photograph of a speeding bullet in midair.
Yeah, that's a perfect analogy.
You have to force the temperature up instantly so the metal is forced to show its true, immediate isothermal behavior. You don't give the atoms the time to slowly cheat their way into a different chemical state while the furnace is leisurely warming up. You strip away all the variables, blast it with heat, hold it steady, and just watch what the crystal lattice does.
And the data they got back from the dilatometer when they did this was exactly what they needed to break this mystery wide open.
So what did the dilatometer actually show when they blasted these little rods with heat? The lever rule says it should start transforming immediately at lower temperatures. Did it?
It did not.
Not at all.
The dilatometer showed that below 760 degrees Celsius, the transformation back to austenite is completely stalled and incomplete. Like at 680 degrees, the amount of transformation is almost zero.
It just sits there.
It just sits there. It starts to tick up slightly as you increase the hold temperature, but it only fully transforms, breaking the lock and becoming a 100% austenitic state when the temperature hits 760 degrees Celsius and above.
But why 760 degrees? What is so magical about that specific amount of heat?
This is the core theoretical breakthrough of Yang and Padacea's paper. It all comes back to that prematurely frozen state, the T0 curve that we talked about earlier.
Right.
Remember how the initial cooling left the carbon locked in an unbalanced tense state?
The uncoiled wind-up toy.
Exactly. Their new theory proves that reaustenitization, the reverse process of turning back into austenite, only begins when the carbon concentration of that leftover residual austenite actually exceeds its natural equilibrium point.
Wait, let me try to visualize this. Earlier, I was thinking of it like a toll booth, where you just pay a fee of heat to open a gate. But it sounds much more violent than that.
Much more.
Is it more like trying to push a really heavy boulder out of a deep crater?
Oh, that's good.
Because you can't just apply a gentle, steady heat, like a light push, and expect the metal to change. Because it froze prematurely during cooling and dropped into this thermodynamic crater, you have to provide a massive, sudden surge of extreme thermal energy.
Right.
You have to push that carbon boulder all the way up and over the rim before the metal is allowed to roll down the other side and finally change its state.
That is a much more accurate metaphor. The lever rule assumes you are starting with a boulder on a flat plane, like a clean slate.
But it's not a clean slate.
No, this steel has a thermodynamic debt from its initial incomplete formation. In metallurgy, the expected starting line for the transformation is called the AE3 curve. But because of this carbon lock, you have to push the temperature significantly past the expected AE3 curve just to overcome the debt.
So the history of the metal literally dictates its future behavior.
Absolutely.
The degree of transformation to austenite today is entirely a function of the temperature at which the original microscopic needles formed yesterday.
Exactly. You cannot predict the reheated structure without knowing the exact chemical trauma of the first cooling cycle.
Wow. But wait. Carbon is just one element in this alloy. This is high-strength structural steel used in skyscrapers. There are heavy elements in the mix too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Carbon is acting as the primary gatekeeper, dictating when the transformation restarts. But to understand the full picture, the Cambridge researchers had to look at those heavier elements too.
Okay.
And what they discovered was a highly complex, chaotic, microscopic traffic jam happening at the exact same time.
How do you even observe a physical traffic jam of individual heavy atoms? Because the dilatometer just measures the overall length of the rod expanding and contracting, right? It can't see the individual elements moving.
Correct, it can't. To see the actual elements, they had to use transmission electron microscopy, or TEM, along with energy dispersive X-ray analysis.
Oh, so literally shooting electrons at it.
Yeah, this allows you to shoot a beam of electrons through an incredibly thin slice of the metal to map out exactly where specific elements are hiding. They were specifically looking at how heavy elements like manganese and nickel were distributed right at the microscopic borders between the ferrite needles and the surrounding austenite.
So what did the electron microscope reveal about those borders?
It showed that even during incredibly short holding times in the furnace, and we are talking just 2 minutes at 760 degrees Celsius.
That's nothing.
Barely any time at all. But these heavier alloying elements were already redistributing. They were actively attempting to move across the transformation boundary. And this introduces two incredibly dense but vital concepts, periequilibrium versus local equilibrium.
Okay, can we break those down? What is the actual difference between periequilibrium and local equilibrium when you're dealing with different elements?
Sure. Think of it like a chaotic foot race between different sized athletes. Mm-hmm. Carbon atoms are tiny. They are what we call interstitial elements, meaning they are small enough to easily fit into the empty gaps between the much larger iron atoms.
Okay.
Because of this, they can diffuse or sprint through the metal incredibly fast.
Because they're just dodging between the big guys.
Exactly. Manganese and nickel atoms, however, are massive. They are substitutional elements. To move even a tiny bit, they have to physically shove an iron atom out of the way and swap places with it. They are incredibly slow.
So in periequilibrium, the heavy, slow-moving elements like manganese and nickel are essentially structurally frozen in place because they just can't swap places fast enough. But the fast-moving carbon sprints around the lattice, easily to reach a balanced state.
Correct. And the paper notes that when the driving force for the transformation is really high, like when you blast it with the radio frequency furnace, the system initially tends toward this periequilibrium state. It's the path of least resistance.
So carbon is sprinting around, easily finding balance, but the manganese and nickel are moving through microscopic molasses.
Yes.
But wait, if I am driving a heavy semi-truck over a bridge in winter, and those heavy manganese elements are trapped in a chaotic traffic jam inside the weld beneath me, does that mean the bridge is physically stressed at a microscopic level?
Yeah.
Like, does that traffic jam weaken the steel?
It makes it incredibly unpredictable, which honestly is an engineer's worst nightmare. The electron microscope data showed something even more chaotic than just slow elements. The researchers looked at the partition coefficients,
which is the ratio of how these heavy elements are divided between the two different structures.
Yes. If the system was in a neat, perfect equilibrium, that ratio would stay constant. The elements would be perfectly evenly distributed.
But they aren't.
No. The data showed that as time increased, even slightly, the partition coefficient kept rapidly changing, meaning the chemical border between the transforming metals is just a mess. It is not a clean, perfect equilibrium at all.
Because the physical boundary between the ferrite and austenite is actually moving as the metal transforms.
Right.
And as that border moves, it is sweeping up these heavy, slow elements like a snowplow.
That's exactly it. And the paper points out that this trapping of elements increases their chemical potential. It basically makes them highly unstable. So you have carbon zipping around trying to find balance, heavy elements getting violently bulldozed and trapped by moving physical boundaries, and the chemical composition at the interface is just constantly, unpredictably shifting.
Man, no wonder predicting the final reheated microstructure is described by these researchers as a formidable theoretical problem.
It's incredibly tough.
You have thermodynamic locks, shape-shifting crystals shearing like decks of cards, and a chaotic traffic jam of elements all happening in a fraction of a millimeter in a matter of seconds.
It really gives you a profound respect for the material science involved in something as seemingly brute force as welding two pieces of metal together.
Definitely. Let's bring all this together and kind of recap the journey we just took. We essentially shrank down and ventured inside a reheated steel weld. We discovered how the primary microstructure, specifically acicular ferrite, completely breaks standard thermodynamic rules by freezing prematurely during cooling.
The incomplete reaction phenomenon. It leaves the carbon locked in an unbalanced state, creating a massive thermodynamic debt.
Right. And to figure out how to unlock it, we looked at how researchers used extreme up-quenching dilatometry with zero thermal mass furnaces.
Which is just brilliant.
By instantly blasting the metal with heat, they proved that a massive thermal pushing that boulder out of the crater is required to break that carbon lock before the metal can even begin to transform.
All while a microscopic traffic jam is occurring. Even when the temperature is high enough to force the transformation, the tiny carbon atoms sprint to find balance, while the heavier elements, like manganese and nickel, are bulldozed by moving boundaries.
Creating a chaotic non-equilibrium border that is basically incredibly difficult to model.
Exactly.
So why should you, listening to this right now, care about the movement of microscopic nickel atoms in a weld?
Well, because this isn't just abstract physics happening in a Cambridge laboratory. This is the fundamental ground-level science required to design the high-strength welding consumables used in the real world.
Right.
When you drive over a massive suspension bridge, or when you are inside a skyscraper swaying in the wind, or on a cargo ship pounding through ocean waves, the structural integrity of those massive constructs relies entirely on multipass welds. Engineers must account for these stubborn, rule-breaking microscopic behaviors to formulate the exact right chemical makeup of the welding rods.
Because if they don't
understand how the reheated zones are going to behave, if they don't account for the carbon lock or the traffic jam, the weld could become brittle and just shatter. Our infrastructure literally relies on mastering this microscopic chaos.
It completely changes how you look at the built world around us. Which honestly leaves me with one final lingering thought to ponder for everyone listening.
Mm-hmm.
We've just spent this entire deep dive learning that a perfectly solid piece of high-strength steel is actually locked in a frozen, unfinished state of physical tension carrying a thermodynamic debt.
Right.
It is just waiting for the exact right threshold of extreme heat to radically rewrite its internal architecture. So if engineers are having this much trouble managing the frozen incomplete states of steel just to keep our bridges standing, imagine the possibilities if we could intentionally master this.
Oh, wow.
Could we purposely freeze other materials midway through their natural transformations, locking in that tension to unlock entirely new states of matter? Imagine a world where we build structures not out of finished materials, but out of materials paused perfectly mid-reaction, waiting to unleash their stored energy exactly when we need it.